We're taking a look at the confirmation hearings that are underway for Governor Tony Evers' cabinet nominees. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The full Senate must vote to approve Governor Evers' cabinet secretaries, and Senate hearings are underway before committees. We'll begin with looking at testimony from Corrections Secretary-designee Kevin Carr. What are your thoughts on Governor Evers' pick for corrections? What are the policies, biggest changes you think need to be made in Wisconsin when it comes to criminal justice? We're at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Laurel White is WPR's state capitol reporter. Laurel, thanks for being here. Hey, Laurel, are you there?
Yep. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you. So Secretary designee for the Department of Corrections, Kevin Carr, faced his confirmation hearing yesterday. What is his background?
So Kevin Carr has been on the scene for quite a while. He was a U.S. Marshal in the Milwaukee area. And prior to that, he spent 30 years in the Milwaukee County Sheriff's Office. So he's an individual that a lot of state lawmakers are familiar with. And that came up a bit yesterday during his confirmation hearing.
So he's had connections with lawmakers. He's had those relationships there.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. And people are aware of the kind of work that he did within the Milwaukee County Sheriff's Office. So that adds a little bit of a background, a little bit of a foundation for his confirmation hearings when he talks about what he wants to do with the department.
One corrections issue that's really dominated in recent weeks and years is about the possibility of this delay of closure of the state's youth prison, Lincoln mm-hmm. Hills for School for Boys and Copper Lake. So how did Carr address Lincoln Hills?
So what's interesting about this is the delay of the closure of Lincoln Hills, I believe, was first reported kind of toward the end of last month. And the closure was slated for 2021. That's mm-hmm. something that lawmakers passed during the last session. Governor Scott Walker signed it. But the Evers administration came out and said, you know, we're not quite so sure about that timeline. We're not sure if we're going to be able to hit that 2 years and do this effectively. Speaking with lawmakers yesterday, Carr really seemed committed to maybe that longer timeline. He told lawmakers in response to a little bit of their pushback, honestly, that the Evers administration would like to move the inmates tomorrow from those facilities if they could, but they weren't going to do that until they found an acceptable place to move them to, until those places were established. And he said, you know, we need to be realistic about the timeline of creating those acceptable sites to move these inmates to.
Right, because all of these regional facilities are supposed to rise up. Is that right?
Mm-hmm. That's right. So there are about 170 inmates at Lincoln Hills and Copper Lake right now, and they would all be scattered across the entire state to smaller regional facilities that are meant to be more integrated with their communities. They're meant to be closer to their families, kind of these smaller, more, you know, intimate facilities for these individuals. So getting all of those set up across the state is something that the Evers administration says is going to take a little bit more time than the Walker administration had previously set out.
And some of these facilities would be new construction. So you still have to build buildings and put facilities up. Is that right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's my understanding. I think there's been talk of repurposing some older facilities, but I believe that building new facilities is something that's still on the table.
Talking with Laurel White, she is WPR State Capitol reporter. We're talking about the State Senate confirmation hearings that were held yesterday for Corrections Department Secretary-designee Kevin Carr. What are your thoughts on Governor Evers' picks for corrections and for transportation secretaries? What are the biggest policy changes you think need to happen in Wisconsin when it comes to criminal justice? We're at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. So Laurel, Carr addressed staffing shortages as part mm-hmm. of his testimony, I understand. What was his evaluation about how we got to these shortages, and what did he point out there?
So he talked a lot about the staffing shortages within the Department of Corrections. He said the current vacancy rate for correctional officers, for example, is about 17%. And he said, you know, that's not a vacancy that we get to overnight, and that's something, not something that we're going to be able to fix overnight. But he talked about things like compensation for those individuals. He talked about ramping up recruitment. And he talked about things that they can do to retain people. But really what he focused on most was that salary element and how much the State Department of Corrections might be able to raise that salary to be a little bit more competitive with other states in the Midwest. It sounds like we're lagging behind fairly substantially from our neighbors in that regard.
Did he offer any strategies for addressing this if he's confirmed to run the department?
Yeah, so he talked a lot about some research that his department has done just in terms of getting a baseline for correctional officer salary in the region. And he said that, you know, they looked at Illinois, Minnesota, Michigan, et cetera. And based on that information, they found that the regional average was about $22 an hour for a correctional officer. Wisconsin is currently paying about $16 an hour. He said a high example was Illinois, I believe, and he said that's $26 an hour. So he said, you know, we're not going to be able to get to that average of 22 from 16 overnight. But he said that these are steps that he believes we need to take to help, you know, get people into these jobs, which are difficult, and to stay in the jobs. Right now, he said employee morale is pretty low, in part because of that salary, but also because of the vacancy rates and the amount of overtime that individuals are having to put in. And then, of course, the state is paying overtime. So there's a lot of financial considerations as this pay increase might happen in terms of, you know, how many more people get into the jobs, how much would overtime go down, all of those factors.
Did you get a sense that this information that he presented surprised committee members in any way?
It was interesting. You know, I think the staffing shortages for correctional institutions in Wisconsin, we've talked a lot about staffing shortages in particular for those Lincoln Hills and Copper Lake facilities, but it's certainly something that's statewide. I think lawmakers were aware of that. I think they were struck based on their reactions by that 17% number, thinking that was pretty high. They were also seemingly fairly surprised about that salary number. And that's not something that I had been familiar with before or heard about, kind of that where Wisconsin falls within that regional spectrum. So lawmakers seemed engaged with that conversation about, you know, potentially raising that number a little bit if possible.
Did he offer any sense of what Governor Tony Evers might do in the forthcoming budget address, the budget when it comes to corrections?
Mm-hmm. That's what's on everybody's mind right now. You know, the governor's budget address is next Thursday. So he did offer a couple little tidbits. I think, you know, the most interesting was related to that salary discussion. He said, I believe the governor is going to address this salary issue in a significant way in the state budget. So he didn't offer any specifics. We don't know what significant means. I did reach out to the governor's office and they didn't confirm that they're going to include a salary increase or offer any specific numbers. But obviously, as head of the State Department of Corrections, he's probably aware of some of the, a little bit of more of the bits and pieces of the governor's budget than the average Joe. So we're definitely going to be keeping a close eye on that salary number when the governor rolls out his budget next week.
We're talking with Laurel White. She is WPR's state capitol reporter, talking about yesterday's confirmation hearings. Department of Corrections Secretary Designee Kevin Carr went before the Senate Judiciary Committee trying to persuade the body to recommend that the state Senate confirm him. You can join in this conversation at 800-642-1234. What are your thoughts on Governor Evers' cabinet picks? What do you make of his top advisors? And what do you think needs to happen in Wisconsin when it comes to corrections? We're at 800-642-1234. Stay with us on the Ideas Network. We're breaking down the latest news out of the state capitol here on The Morning Show. I'm Kedar Chirkent, and we've been looking at testimony from Corrections Secretary Designee Kevin Carr. We're also going to explore the sticking points in the governor's budget. Lawmakers on both sides of the aisle want to see an income tax cut, but they don't see eye to eye on how to pay for it. What do you think? Do you like one side's plan more than the other? And what would a tax cut like this mean for you? Let us know at 800-642-1234. We're talking about it with Laurel White. She is Wisconsin Public Radio's State Capitol reporter. Laurel, the governor's budget will be announced, as you mentioned, in the coming week. What has he said he'd like to include?
So we have kind of, I would say, a top four of the big things that the governor says he's going to include in the budget. I think the biggest one of that is one that's made headlines, you know, as recently as last night and this morning. It's that tax cut for middle income earners in Wisconsin. The governor vetoed the Republican plan that was passed by the state legislature last night, saying, you know, kind of reiterating those concerns that he had with the Republican plan and reaffirming his own plan and kind of why he thought it was better. So we know he's going to have that plan, his Democrat-backed plan, in his state budget. We also know he's going to have some big spending increases for education. He's talked about these since he was on the campaign trail. Obviously, he's the former head of the State Department of Public Instruction, so this is a really big interest area for him and an area of expertise. He's going to include some specifics there, some spending increases for special education, as well as increases for mental health services in schools and things like early childhood programs. We also know the governor is going to include a Medicaid expansion in the budget. This has been a really contentious issue in the state capitol for several years now. This is something that Governor Scott Walker turned down, but Democrats have pushed him to take. Evers says he is going to take that it will expand coverage for Wisconsinites, but also free up some money in the state budget to do some other things. But Republican lawmakers don't appear to be on board. So that's going to be an interesting debate after he includes that in the budget. And then I think the last big piece of those big four is the transportation revenue solution, which is something we're not entirely sure about yet. The governor has a transportation task force that is working on this for him. He'll include their recommendations in his budget. We have gotten hints recently, though, that that's looking like it might be a gas tax increase as a way to kind of beef up those revenues and pay for more road projects in Wisconsin.
And he said he'd like to explore the opportunity for medical marijuana in Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. What do we know there?
Absolutely. So this is a big one that's gotten some headlines this week. The governor said he will include medical marijuana in his budget proposal. Obviously, that means that folks with a doctor's note can have a marijuana prescription to treat a number of different conditions. But there are some other marijuana proposals that aren't related to medical marijuana. He also says he's going to make it legal for an individual to have less than 25 grams of marijuana in their possession for any reason. He wants to set up some expungement procedures for individuals that have marijuana possession on their records, as long as they've fulfilled their sentence and probation and met some other criteria, they'd be able to have that expunged from their record. And he also wants to make some changes to the regulation of CBD oil in Wisconsin, which has made major headlines over the past several years. As of right now, individuals can have CBD oil, which is made from cannabis, if they have a doctor's note. But under the governor's proposal, they would be able to acquire and use CBD oil without that doctor's note.
Do we have any indications on how these proposals sit with Republicans? What do lawmakers think about these proposals on marijuana?
So it's really interesting because, in particular, the head of the state assembly, Assembly Speaker Robin Voss, has said that he's open to medical marijuana potentially. He's been saying that for a while. But he said that the governor's proposal in this instance, he believes, goes just a little bit too far. He says that some of these other things that don't have to do with medical marijuana set up too much of a gateway, a pathway, if you will, toward full legalization, which is something that he doesn't support. He wants medical marijuana to be pretty strictly regulated and supervised so it doesn't go down that road. On the other hand, in the state Senate, Senate Majority Leader Scott Fitzgerald has never expressed support for medical marijuana. He said, he told reporters late last year that he really didn't see that passing the state Senate. And when asked for updated comment this week after the governor rolled out his proposal, the senator didn't offer any new perspectives or opinions. So it looks like the governor's proposals are facing a pretty uphill climb in the state legislature.
We're talking with Laurel White. She's WPR's state capitol reporter. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you want to see come out of Governor Evers' forthcoming budget? What does your community need for this budget? What do you think a tax cut proposal should look like? Share your hopes, your needs with us at 800-642-1234. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Laurel, UW System's tuition freeze happened under Governor Walker, and now Governor Evers is planning to implement one as well. Can you tell us about the history there and what we might see?
So Governor Walker first implemented this tuition freeze for the UW system in 2013 for in-state undergraduate students, and he's continued that tuition freeze every budget since then. This is something that he was really proud of, that he talked about a lot when he was in office. But it also got some pushback from particularly Democratic state lawmakers and some advocacy groups, because they said that while the governor was putting in place this freeze, which he said made college more affordable for folks, they said he wasn't, quote unquote, funding the freeze, which means, you know, putting more state resources into these schools that have a stagnant number of tuition dollars coming in. So what Governor Evers says he's going to do is fund that freeze. He wants to increase state resources so universities, as a part of the UW system, don't have to reduce costs or find ways to scrimp and save as, you know, inflation hits the campus.
So do you have a sense of how much spending we'll see on higher education?
We don't. You know, the governor hasn't been specific about his higher ed plan, unlike his specifics with his K-12 plan. You know, we've had those numbers for quite a while. So we're going to have to keep an eye on the higher ed plan and, you know, how he plans to fund that freeze. And he did talk a little bit yesterday about infrastructure investments and putting more money into repair and maintenance of buildings within the UW system. So that looks like he's planning to spend some money there as well. But again, we don't have any specific numbers at this point.
Do you feel like with what we have heard roll out so far that we have perhaps more glimpses or insights into the roadmap for Governor Evers' budget than we have in the past? Or is it, do governors always kind of send these morsels along the way up until they introduce their budget?
You know, I think they always, at least Governor Walker, would definitely tease some things from his state budget before he rolled it out. But I think Governor Evers has been rolling out quite a few pieces of his budget in advance, which I think is an interesting strategy, and that he's allowing people to sort of sift through and digest some kind of maybe lower profile things in addition to some of the big things that I talked about before. He's doing these across the state, these rollouts of different budget pieces. He's talked about things like water quality. He's talked about things like rural dental care, and he's done them in different parts of the state. And I think that's potentially his way of saying, look, I traveled the state during my campaign. Here are things that are targeted at each region that I'm looking to do to support the state in my budget. We know that that's something the governor really wants to do. He wants to engage the public in this budget discussion. He's called it the people's budget. And I think that's one sort of chip in his bargaining, you know,
arsenal.
Arsenal. There we go. Yeah. When he talks to Republican lawmakers, because they do have those majorities. So I think he can, you know, if he says, look, I have the public on my side, these are the things that they want. Maybe there isn't as much support within the Republican caucus for specific things. But if he says, look, everybody, you've got constituents calling you and saying that they want this, let's try to meet in the middle potentially. So that's something he's talked about for a concrete example, on the marijuana proposal and public opinion of medical marijuana legalization. So it's going to be interesting to see how he sort of negotiates going forward.
Let's take a quick call here. Mark joining us. Mark, go ahead. Hey, Mark, are you there?
Yes, I'm here. Good morning.
Good morning.
Where can we, the general public, get a bullet-pointed list comparing and contrasting what each side is proposing in the budget?
Mark, thanks for the call. Mark really would love a synthesis here as to where everyone is at with a bullet point list on each side.
Yeah, and that's something that we're definitely going to be working on. We don't have the full proposal from the governor yet. We'll get that next Thursday. And we don't have the full proposal from Republicans yet. In fact, there's been some back and forth about whether Republicans are going to come up with a separate proposal or not. They had talked about just working from the governor's budget and sort of nipping and tucking and tweaking as they go with his proposal. But now, based on some of the things the governor says he's going to include, it does look like there's going to be a separate Republican plan, and we'll certainly be focusing on those differences moving forward.
Laurel, thank you for joining us.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Laurel White is WPR State Capitol reporter. Up next, it's news. Then the Tide Pod Challenge provoked hand-wringing over eating detergent pods. We'll look into the public safety right here on the Ideas Network. We're talking about the dangers of laundry pods here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Procter & Gamble brought them to our world in the form of Tide Pods in 2012, and these concentrated and candy-colored packets of detergent have really swept the marketplace, and they've been in the news. Parents and caregivers, have you talked to your children about not eating laundry pods or about chemicals we keep in our houses? What did you tell them? And does it frustrate you that you have to do that about products you use? We're at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Jake Meth is an associate editor at Fortune magazine. His recent cover story for Fortune is called The Tragic Side of Tide Pods. Jake, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Hi, Kate. Yeah, thank you.
Well, let's start with the story of 8-year-old Bella, and you share this story as you look at laundry pods and specifically Tide Pods. What happened to Bella?
Right. So when Bella was 2 years old, she was in her home. Her mother had just bought her first case of Tide Pods, and this was in 2012, the year that they were launched. And no one really knew much about them at the time. And these pods were inside a clear plastic tub, which a lot of people would say looks like a candy jar. And when her mother looked away for a second, Bella opened the tub, and took out a pod and bit into it. And she was only two at the time, so she had no idea. You know, she was too young to know what she was doing. And as a result of that, she ingested a little bit of the detergent inside of it, and that caused her eventually to go into a serious medical situation where she stopped breathing, she briefly flatlined, and she had to be intubated for over 2 weeks while they tried to clear her lungs of the laundry detergent that had flooded it. She barely lived.
How is she doing today?
She's doing much better. It was really comforting to see that she was a functioning, happy-go-lucky 8-year-old today. But she's been through the ringer. She has had two major eye surgeries because she had a condition, or continues to have a condition called strabismus, which causes her eyes to be misaligned vertically. And that has led to situations where she would just be falling down, tripping over herself, basically had huge balance problems. It's gotten a lot better, but she's had major issues with that, and she also was more prone to sickness after the event. And all of these conditions her doctors attributed to the oxygen deprivation that she experienced during the Tide Pod incident.
So given what we know about these detergent-related injuries, Are these cases like Bella's the norm?
Bella's case is not the norm, mm-hmm. and it's important that we say that most situations that involve these do not result in someone almost dying. That said, though, in terms of laundry detergent as a category, pods only make up about 16% of that market, but they make up 80% of major injuries that are related to laundry detergent. And so when injuries are serious, they're more serious, and pods are much more likely to cause an injury where someone has to go and get medical treatment than you would experience with regular laundry detergent or even with your average household cleaning product.
Well, what is the history of these laundry detergent pods? What is the backstory here? How did they come to be?
So back in the middle of the 2000s, Procter & Gamble was looking for a product that would energize the laundry detergent category. And they started working on a way to create a single-dose packet of laundry detergent that contained liquid that tends to clean better than powder. And so they developed this product over a course of 8 years. And in 2012, they launched it. And they were really excited about it because the laundry detergent category was becoming commoditized. People were no longer just going to the store to buy Tide. They were going to just buy whatever was the cheapest detergent, and Tide Pods allowed Procter & Gamble to have a distinguished product on the shelves. And so when they launched it, it became a big hit for them. People love the product, and over the course of from then until today, it's become a major product for them, and it's captured about a fifth of the laundry detergent market.
We're looking at the history of laundry pods and the public safety risk and what companies and regulators are doing about them. Jake Meth is an associate editor at Fortune magazine. Have you or someone you know ingested a laundry pod, like a Tide pod? What happened? Or do you refuse to keep them in the house to protect young children or older adults with dementia-related illness who may think they're candy? You can call in at 800-642-1234, email ideas@WPR.org. Jake, when did concerns about these and their connection to laundry detergent-related injuries, when did something arise here that people started turning their heads and noticing this?
So almost immediately, the product came out in February of 2012, and I believe it was in May that the CDC issued a warning that this was an emerging public health hazard because poison control centers were reporting a huge spike in calls related to this new product, and the poison control centers didn't even really know exactly how to treat them because they were a new product. So that was a very quick response. And the way that most people know about this, the dangers of pods, at least recently, was this Tide Pod Challenge internet phenomenon that went on at the end of 2017 into early 2018. And that was a serious problem. There were a lot of teenagers who were intentionally ingesting them as a sort of like a kind of online dare. But in terms of the absolute number of poison incidents, those were relatively low compared to young children under the age of six.
Looking more closely at this Tide Pod Challenge and what was happening on the internet, how did this affect how laundry pod poisoning was viewed and is viewed today?
The challenge definitely brought more public attention to the problem. There was definitely some attention when the product came out in 2012 and 2013. But then after that, the industry made safety changes to the product, and even consumer advocates and the industry at that time were happy with the changes that were being made. And so in 2017, the numbers in terms of calls to poison control and emergency room visits had not really dropped below what they were when the product came out, but the issue was not really in the public consciousness. And so when the Tide Pod Challenge happened, it brought that back into the limelight. And as one result of that, two lawmakers from New York State began to put a lot of pressure on Procter & Gamble to change, to make further safety changes to the product. Even though they were focusing on young children, the media attention around the Tide Pod Challenge sort of gave them the opening to bring this issue back into the limelight.
What has P&G done? How have they responded to concerns over safety and to these incidents involving laundry pods?
So P&G and other manufacturers, and it's worth mentioning that P&G is the focus here because they take up about 80% of the pod market. They made, you know, significant safety changes over the years, over the 7 years since the product's been out. And in 2015, they made they agreed to a set of standards that are they're legally bound to, in which pods need to be in a very difficult to open external package. It needs to be opaque, so you can't see through what's inside of it. And they need to have standard warning labels on it. And also, they changed the pods themselves so that they have a bittering agent on them, so you'd have to spit it out very quickly. They can withstand a certain amount of pressure, and they don't dissolve as quickly in water. These changes have been made, and they went into effect at the beginning of 2017. Since then, we've been able to see the data from 2017, and while there was a drop in terms of the number of incidents related to pods when adjusted for market size, because there are more pods on the market, the absolute number of incidents with emergency room visits and calls to poison control still have not dropped below what they were in 2013. So you've had basically a five-year period where the number of incidents has basically stayed. It went up a little bit, and then it went back down to where it was at the start.
And besides the lawmakers in New York, how have regulators been a part of this?
So laundry pods are regulated by the Consumer Product Safety Commission, and they've played a role in the process in 2015 when safety standards were developed. They pushed they actually went public and made a statement, which is rare for them, pushing manufacturers to make safety changes. And they brought consumer advocates into the process and tried to make it a holistic process to change the safety. Since then, they've largely played a more passive role. They haven't issued any public statements, and the last statement that we got from them when reporting the article was that they were satisfied with the progress that was made in 2017, and that but that they were still looking to help continue the safety of related to the number of ingestions.
Fortune Magazine's Jake Meth stays with us. His recent cover story for Fortune is called The Tragic Side of Tide Pods. Stay with us for this conversation on the Ideas Network. We're talking about the issues of laundry pods here in the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Last year, Tide was caught in the middle of this unexpected viral trend called the Tide Pod Challenge, in which teenagers dared one another to consume Tide Pod detergent packets, which contain poisonous substances. And we're looking at the implications for laundry pod makers and the public health challenge surrounding these products. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you refuse to buy laundry pods because you're worried about something in your house and who might use them for the wrong reasons or think they may be candy? And how do you manage keeping products you use out of the hands of kids and vulnerable adults? Call in, tweet us, WPR Mornings. We're talking with Jake Meth, who covered the public safety concerns surrounding laundry pods for his recent cover story for Fortune magazine titled The Tragic Side of Tide Pods. Let's go to the phones now with Paula joining us from La Crosse. Hi, Paula.
Oh, hi. Yeah, my comment is exactly what you just mentioned, is I was wondering where in the discussion, and obviously any child that gets hurt, anything in a household is tragic and horrible, but the parents' responsibility, any household product and or appliance and or is a danger to little toddler children and or a child. So, yeah, very, very important, I believe, to where is that in the discussion.
Paula, thanks for the call. Jake, this really comes down to, as Paula says, is about protecting your own children who are vulnerable to all of these different things in the home.
Absolutely. And this is one of the more difficult questions that we tried to confront in this article because, like Paula's saying, there are a lot of it is a legitimate point that parents need to make sure that their households are safe for their children. What we found with this product that's a little bit different than other household products, though, is that this product, so for example, if you have a product like bleach, right, we all know that bleach is dangerous, and it's not in a package that is attractive to a young child. And so kind of the elephant in the room of this whole story is that laundry pods are, despite all the safety changes that have been made, they're still designed to look very colorful and exciting in a way that a lot of people believe looks like candy. And so when you have a product that's causing a lot of safety issues, what consumer advocates have been saying is, why don't we make a change that would make this less attractive to children? It doesn't take away the responsibility of parents to make sure that the product is safely stored and to watch their children, but it may improve the numbers related to safety.
Let's go to Marcus now in Milwaukee. Hi, Marcus.
Good morning, Kate. So there's, I actually just came across it yesterday. There's a fantastic video clip from Dr. Jillian Theobald at Frederick's of Milwaukee, and she basically explains, you know, the dangers and some suggestions on how to deal with or mitigate the risk of child accidentally swallowing these. But I agree with Paula. I think it really comes down to parental responsibility and just teaching your kids and, you know, making sure things are put away.
As Marcus says, that there is safety education out there for using products. Is there safety education around laundry pods?
Absolutely. And this is something I also wanted to mention, was that, you know, we spoke extensively with Procter & Gamble throughout the reporting of this article, and they emphasized two main things. The first is that they made changes to the exterior packaging and to certain changes to the product to make it safer, like we discussed earlier. And the other thing that they really emphasized was that they've done, they made a huge push to educate caregivers and parents about the safety of the product, putting it up away from the hands of children, and making sure that it's closed after it's being used and not leaving pods out. And so that's been their emphasis. And from what we could understand, the way that they look at this issue is that they're doing everything they can to make sure that the, and they've actually said this, that their priority is to make sure that the pod never gets into the child's hands in the first place. And this is their approach to the safety problem. And the consumer advocates basically have said on the other side that, yes, it's great that you're doing these things, but that there may be further changes that need to be made. And that's kind of where the debate is centered right now.
Let's go to Jessica joining us from Portage. Good morning, Jessica.
Morning.
What are your thoughts on Tide Pods and other laundry pods?
I love my Tide Pods, and I will keep buying them. I have a three-year-old. They save me a lot of trouble when I have to go to the laundromat and wash stuff because I don't have to lug big jugs of laundry detergent. And honestly, with the teenagers have been doing stupid stuff for forever, like dumping boiling hot water on themselves or lighting themselves on fire. So Villainizing one product isn't going to stop teenagers from being dumb.
Jessica, do you take extra steps, though, with your pods because you do have a toddler?
Well, of course, I keep all my chemicals and stuff either in a locked cabinet or high up that she can't reach them. I mean, it's just common sense.
Jessica, thanks for the call. Jake, you know, consumers like these products, these pods. Are they popular?
Yeah, they're very popular, and we're hearing that in the calls, too. They make up, between when they launched and now, the amount of pods on the market, or their share of the market, they grew 136%, and laundry detergents grew 7% during that period, like overall laundry detergents. So they've been huge. They make up about $1.5 billion in sales each year. And they've really become a popular product because of, like the previous caller was saying, they're really easy to use and they're convenient. One point to make, just additional point on that, is that what I think it has continued to happen is that the safety issue with this has been continued to be conflated with that of teenagers. And so what this article is trying to do was to really emphasize that this is actually for children who are under the age of 6, and actually most of them are 1 or 2 years old who really don't know any better and think that they look like candy. And also the other population at risk that we found is seniors with dementia. And in that situation, it's actually more difficult to keep them safe because you can't keep the pods away from them as easily.
And you tell a story of one such person with dementia. You know, we don't really think about that in terms of other older populations, but that is a problem.
It's a huge problem, and we don't have enough data on that because the poison control centers don't collect data at a certain age. They don't collect 70 and over or ages like that. They mostly segmented by very younger ages. But we do know that 7 seniors with dementia have died since 2013 in cases related to laundry pods, and one of whom was Dennis Powers, who we spoke with his family for the article. And he actually tried to eat 5 of them. It was a really horrible story. Obviously, his family had no idea that a product like this could be so dangerous when they bought it.
Very quickly, as we wrap up, what are you watching for when it comes to legislation on these pods?
Well, we'll see what happens with the New York State legislation. The lawmakers have said that they're going to continue pushing, but this legislation has been stalled for about 4 or 5 years now, I think. Some advocates told me that they are hoping Congress will step in, and Congress did introduce a bill back in 2015 when the numbers of incidents was at its highest. But generally, the approach has been both with Congress and with federal regulators to have the industry make these changes voluntarily. And so there's nothing on the horizon right now, but that could change. It really just depends on whether there's a public perception that this product is dangerous.
Jake, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Jake Meth is an associate editor at Fortune magazine, and his recent cover story for Fortune is called The Tragic Side of Tide Pods. You hear this conversation on The Morning Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network.